and some of our other institutional costs come down, or at least represent a smaller portion of the program. We are here to tell you that we are not asking for new money again for Medicaid. This is the second year in a row that we have been able to absorb the increases that occur in this entitlement program. And I'm very thankful to the division staff who do a very good job managing this program. You will see in the budget that it looks like it grows, and that's because there are some transfers that we're proposing to move into the program, API funds and some other funds. We've also decreased the general relief medical program by $2 million. We are continuing to see a decline in that need, although it's possible with welfare reform changes that we may see some increases in the next year. And as I mentioned, one of the other changes that occurred is that we have eliminated 300 individuals who were using entitlement services for drug and alcohol. They were drug and alcohol addicted, and so those funds have been removed from the budget. Just wanting to let you know that you gave us a homework assignment to reduce the Medicaid budget by $4 million last year, and the result of that was we did that, we believe, and primarily we did it by asking the hospitals and the nursing homes to take a reduction in their expenses. This was probably the most aggressive reduction. It's a reduction in growth, but it was the most aggressive reduction that has occurred in our history in the Medicaid program with providers. We also have been doing some other cost management activities. And as you might know, we're embarking on some managed care pilot programs in a couple of different areas of the state, which will begin us down the road to managed care in Medicaid. 21, just wanted to note for you a couple items. One is we continue to try to ask the federal government to pick up more of the cost of Medicaid through working on some cost recoveries with the Indian Health Service. An item not mentioned here, but I think worth noting, is last year in the federal Medicaid reform, Senator Murkowski and Senator Stevens were successful in getting in the proposal the change in our match rate for Medicaid. Currently, we experience the lowest match rate, which is 50 cents, as I said, dollar for dollar. So every dollar we spend in the state, we get a federal dollar. States have match rates as high as 75%, so that they only spend a quarter when they get 75 cents. So this is an area of great importance to us. There's clear documentation now as a result of these amendments that our match rate should be 62% federal, which would result in some significant savings to the state, both today and in the future. And so that's an area that we continue to have a great interest in, and the governor continues to try to discuss with the delegation. We are requesting the restoration of emergency dental, speech language pathology, and audiology, hearing aids, vision. These are for the adults only. The kids have always been covered, so these are for adults, mostly those elderly and disabled individuals. Are the high-cost users of these services. We have worked out what we think is a pretty good offer, which is that for $1.2 million in state general funds, we can leverage $4.6 million, which is the full cost of these benefit additions. The Mental Health Trust has come in and participated in half of the state match with their funds. So we're trying to make this more affordable in the environment we're in. Just quickly to note, in long-term care, you will see down at the bottom of page 21 the expenditures the state makes in long-term care for people 65 and over. And one of the things to note is that the Pioneer Homes and the private nursing homes are roughly the same size in terms of their systems. They serve roughly 600 people each, or 600 and some, and that all of those systems have one goal in common, which is to provide care the most appropriately and to try to help people stay in their own homes as long as they can in their own communities. So So we have embarked on a joint process with the Department of Administration in strengthening our home and community-based care efforts. We've done that because if you look on page 22 and you look in the middle chart, you will see that, as we all know, we have a growing elderly population in our state. And if you will see the clients that we have in our, the number of individuals who we think might need long-term care, which would be, or home supports, would be 3,000 clients in the year 96. And if you look at, rapidly forward at, in just 10 years, 15 years, you will see that that system will exponentially grow in cost. So, and of course, we value our old people in this state, our elders, and we want to create a system that's affordable. So we are very serious about trying to streamline our long-term care system. We are requesting some transfers to senior services to do that this year. We have centralized our nursing home admissions. We have been looking at the issue of how to create more financing for home and community-based services, one of which is the helping, as an example, of Bethel in implementing assisted living this year. It's an area that does not have any long-term care services. So as we get into the detailed budget, you will see the transfer of the personal care program, the transfer of some of our other functions over to centralize and streamline. Page 24, let me just list a brief initiative here that I'm very happy to say has started. This summer, Seward Hospital came to us and said, Seward Community came to us and said, you know, we have a serious problem in our community. We can't afford the cash flow situation that's occurring in our hospital, our rural hospital, but we don't want to lose the services. What can we do? Through that process, we were able to create a new level of licensure for rural hospitals, which we call the Rural Primary Care Hospital, which we will which will allow communities an option to become licensed with less of the expensive services that used to come with being a full-service hospital. It's an option. It's certainly not a requirement for a community. We also, and with that, will continue to come reimbursement, which is an important point for rural hospitals. They can't afford to convert to these other models if there's not the reimbursement for Medicare, for instance, to follow it. We would like to undertake a second level of dialogue, which gets us probably to a more unique and maybe even more less expensive form of care in rural communities. And we want to do that in partnership with the industry. This will take a congressional waiver, and we are going to work on that. And I just think that it's time for us to help the communities who have small rural hospitals deal with the issues and give them some choices because of the importance of those services to rural communities. Page 26, we talked, I know you spoke with the Mental Health Trust Authority, so I can be brief here in saying that we've had a great partnership with them. It's been a real experience to work on integration, which I think is the focus of the trust. A couple of key events that have happened in the last year, so you know. One is we have, by December of 1997, the state of Alaska will have closed or decertified all what we call ICFMR beds in the state. We will be one of two or three states that have no ICFMR beds. That's a decertification of the Hope Cottages in Anchorage and the closure of Harborview. Those beds are our most expensive beds. They are roughly $150,000 a person a year. And with the decertification and the waiver process, we have been able to continue to serve those individuals and communities at much less cost, and we have been able to expand service with some of the savings. Also, we have streamlined our waiver process from a approximately 6 to 8 month process down to a 60-day process. And then finally, we've transferred some money around to serve seriously emotionally disturbed children in their own homes. with existing funds. We feel that that will be more cost-effective. I guess finally, quality assurance has become a real issue for us in mental health, and we have been working with the trust to beef up our oversight of our mental health programs through this next year. I think, frankly, that's the meat of my presentation, and probably we'll just close with that.
Thank you. Are there questions for the commissioner? I might note that Senator Wilken has joined us at the table. We appreciate your being here. Questions? Biggest budget. There must be questions. Senator Wilken.
Commissioner, on page 21, you spoke of the change in the match rate, or at least the potential of changing the match rate.
Right.
What, just in rough numbers, what would that mean if it did go to 62%? And secondly, what help can we give you to do that?
$40 million in general funds. And I think the help that you could give me is the show of support from the legislature. Not only in the idea, but in how it's done. The change that was in the committee basically was a prospective change. In other words, the state would not realize the savings from the original match change. It would realize savings forward. This has historically been an inequity for us, and I think it's our position that some of those savings should accrue back to the state because they've been revenues that we've expended.
Senator Donnelly.
I had the conference on juvenile justice this summer, and one of the concerns I've talked to the department over the years about is the number of times it takes for a juvenile criminal to commit crimes before the department recommends them go into delinquency proceedings or to be up for waiver to adult court. Have there been any additional studies on that issue?
We've looked at the numbers, the volume of kids coming into the system, and tried to fashion an approach where there's consequences early before the kids even hit DFYS. That's number one. Number two,
musically challenged.
Practice, isn't
it? That's a very serious subject, I'm trying to think here.
Sorry.
We've tried to beef up our probation services so there's more oversight of the kids that are in our custody and perhaps more ability to file petitions. Number three, the conference, what we learned was we lock up kids in this state more and longer than just about any other place. So is that cost effective? Probably not. We need to think of some ways to divert kids. And finally, on the issue of serious offenders, which are a very small number of our population, the conference recommended no more waivers, no more expansion to the waivers, but a dual sentencing process.
Well, that really didn't get to my question. My question was, we ran some numbers over the last couple of years, Joe, and how many times it took for juveniles to commit crimes before the folks in your department ever recommended there be serious sanctions against them before they go into delinquency proceedings. Has there been any additional study of that question? It seemed to me like they didn't ever want to put these criminals, even after four or five times, into delinquency proceedings. So there's no trigger to then really evaluate whether or not, you know, there's no accountability.
I think that the conference looked at all of the numbers, all of the different numbers for the whole picture. And I'm not aware that they made changes in the standards for filing a delinquency petition. I think one point to be made is, what are we going to do with these kids to give them swift consequences? You know, if our facilities are jam-packed and our probation officers are overloaded, what can we do to provide sanctions at every level?
So, well, what does that mean, Commissioner? Does that mean that your individual decision-making folks who are deciding whether somebody should go into delinquency proceedings or not are evaluating those not based on public safety but on the inability of someplace later on in the system to deal with it?
Well, I believe we have guidelines on filing petitions.
Can I get a copy of what the guidelines are? And have those been, have there been any modifications in those over the last couple of years? Because I got all the numbers and I saw how infrequently people are really, these juveniles are recommended for delinquency proceedings, and it seemed rather disturbing to me how many crimes they can get away with before we even go into delinquency proceedings. We're not even talking about going to adult court here. We're just talking about juvenile delinquency.
You know, not to answer directly, but I think what the conference found is that there's an open spigot between a kid committing an offense in the community and the Fairbanks Youth Facility or McLaughlin. There's not enough in between that builds up the consequences early enough. And I'm not sure the state can afford to continually be the only recourse for some of these actions. If we want swift consequences and immediate ones, which we all agree on, then we've got to build up the systems at the community level as well.
Well, my question was, I guess you're just saying that there's these criteria, and you follow the criteria. I'll get a copy of those.
That is all the questions that we have time for this morning. Is there an interest on the part of the committee of having the commissioner come back this afternoon, or if you have further questions, would you like to save them for the welfare reform overview? No one feels it necessary to have Ms. Purdue come back later in the week. We will adjourn the meeting now, but we will reconvene this afternoon at 4:30 for our continuing budget previews. This afternoon, we'll be hearing from Division of Audit and Ledge Finance about the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Public Safety. With that, we're adjourned.
Sorry, a little late.